From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a Sacramento team muscles its way into big-time California high school football. Also, author Todd Borg and his mystery novel set at Lake Tahoe, and the Latino holiday tradition of tamale making. What's it all about, and how does one local family do it? But first, for a while, things looked tough for high-speed rail in California. A bond measure to raise needed funds was delayed several times. But last month, California voters finally got the chance to weigh in on the matter, and they approved Proposition 1A, a $10 billion bond measure that would help pay for initial construction work. Why was funding held up so often? What will this money be used for? And what's the timeline? Joining us by phone is Quentin Kopp, the chairman of the California High Speed Rail Authority. Judge Quentin Kopp, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Why was the bond measure to pay for the start of the construction delayed so often?
Well, you'll have to ask people who were in the legislature and around the state capitol in that period of time. So what I'm giving you is based on hearsay, but I think it's reliable hearsay. In 2002, a bill by then-State Senator Jim Costa of Fresno was passed by over two-thirds of each House, which ordered submission of the $9.95 billion bond issue in the November 2004 election. Then came turmoil. I think it was also called the recall of the then-governor, the election of a new governor. And it was postponed in that turmoil to the 2006 November election. In 2006, the incumbent governor had his own idea about what was, in his mind, a more important bond issue of about $14 billion. It was Proposition 1B, so we took second seat and were postponed until last month, 2008, and it came to a happy ending, at least as part of this first segment of building high-speed rail is concerned.
All this that you just described must have been a frustrating process for you and others at the California High-Speed Rail Authority and also people who supported what you were doing.
Yes, it was. I wasn't appointed to the board until June 2006, but it was indeed frustrating to know that we wouldn't be able to begin our foundational financial underpinning for the high-speed rail project until 2 years later. But anyway, it came out all right. So we continue with the perils of Pauline.
Well, and we'll get to what's going to happen next. But I just have one other question about the past, and that is, were you ever concerned that perhaps this just was not going to work out? And if so, was there a plan B?
I was concerned, obviously, in order for a project of this sort, which is unprecedented in terms of the amount of money involved in the history of California. As a matter of fact, in the history of the United States, this is a project that's larger than the Transcontinental Railroad in terms of the dollars that are needed to implement and complete the project. Of course, I thought maybe that would be the end of the entire quest for high-speed rail in California, and I know that our staff, we have a meager staff consisting of only 6.5 state employees because the design engineering, the EIR analysis are all let under contracts to private firms, but it was a perhaps nadir for the project itself, although we may reach another nadir between now and 2018 when I expect it'll be completed, at least as far as first phase is concerned.
On Insight, we're catching up with what's happening next with some of the propositions that passed in last November's election. Today, we're talking about Proposition 1A, the bond measure for high-speed rail in California. My guest is Quentin Kopp. He's the chairman of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. The repayment of this bond will total about $647 million a year. Can California afford that, given its unprecedented budget problems?
Well, the answer to that is yes, and there are a couple of factors and elements that people ought to be aware of, although I find since the election that many people are not aware of the first such element, which is that these approved bonds will not be sold probably for 2 years. As you probably know, the state treasurer, independent of Proposition 1A, announced about a month ago that he would not sell any state general obligation bonds until the California budget is balanced, and that takes action by the legislature and governor. That's number one. Number two, we cannot begin construction under the law of any segment within the first phase, and the first phase is San Francisco all the way to Anaheim through Los Angeles, until all of the funds needed to complete that segment are certified as available by the State Director of Finance and by the Chairman of the Joint Legislative Budget Committee. That's the first factor. The second is, at such time as our bond is actually sold, either in whole or in part, the State Treasurer will again certify to his constituents, our constituents, the people of the state of California, that the state can afford the repayment of the bonds. The general rule, generally accepted public accounting principles, is that your debt service or payments on approved and sold bonds should not exceed 6.5% of your general fund expenditures. And the general fund expenditures of the state of California are about $100 billion plus. At the present time, debt service on already sold general obligation bonds amounts to 4.1% of general fund expenditures. Even if all the bonds are already approved plus our bond are sold, the debt service will amount to 6.1%. So we're within the generally accepted accounting principle, which means that California can afford the debt service.
That, I guess, assumes the state's fiscal situation doesn't deteriorate to such a point that...
Well, if your general fund, if you cut the general fund expenditures by 30, 40 billion, of course you have a different equation. But I don't think that'll happen.
Yes.
Not with a state with an increasing population and potential tax revenue. There may be a blip now, but we're not going to be going to market for at least 18 months and probably 24 months.
You said that actual construction can't start until all of the money is in place. And this this $9 billion from Proposition 1A is only one relatively small part of the total. There's local funds,
well,
12 to 16.
If you want to look at it theoretically, that's not correct. A segment is a portion of the alignment between San Francisco and Anaheim, and that alignment is San Francisco to San Jose, and then over the Pacheco Pass to Merced and down to Fresno to Bakersfield, Palmdale to downtown Union Station, Los Angeles, then to Anaheim. A segment is a portion within that. For example, Anaheim to Los Angeles. That's probably about a $3 billion cost. Theoretically, you could use the proceeds of Proposition 1A to build that segment first. We'll be opening segments before the entire alignment is completed. Another potential is San Jose to San Francisco. And another potential is Merced to Bakersfield. Why Merced to Bakersfield? Because that'll be our test segment. And under the law which controls any spending upon proceeds, another aspect is that the board of the authority must give preference to a segment in which all the financing is assured. And part of our financial plan contemplates anywhere from $2 to $3 billion from local and regional sources, both public and private. So, for example, if San Jose to San Francisco includes money from local authorities, either the Valley Transportation Authority or private developers in and around San Jose or around San Francisco, and all that money is available. I've forgotten the approximate cost of that segment, but it's probably between $3-4 billion. Mm. then we could proceed with that segment first. And
okay.
As my mother used to preach, nothing succeeds like success itself. And here I put on my encouragement hat. Once people experience high-speed rail, they're going to be sold on it.
Well, as much money as Prop 1A raises, $9 billion for the high-speed rail, there's also another $2 to $3 billion needed for the LA to San Francisco route, $12 to $16 billion in federal funding, and $6.5 to $7.5 billion in public-private partnerships. That's my understanding. How secure? How certain are those other sources of money? That is, the money other than Prop 1A.
Look, in any project, especially a project of this magnitude, you can't be certain of anything. And don't let anyone tell you differently. The significance of Proposition 1A is, however, that California has put money on the table in a national way, in a national context. We have a meeting, for example, this week with Senator Feinstein. I was in D.C. last week and met with a couple of congressional offices, and I was a part of a global infrastructure forum with some 450 firms that are involved in infrastructure projects all over the world, including a couple who expressed interest in private capital participation in California high-speed rail. You know all of the talk from Washington about an economic stimulus package. We're prepared to move almost immediately, for example, on grade crossings. We're going to eliminate about 600 grade crossings. That's concrete, genuine work that's available. Surface Transportation Act is up for renewal. The Senator John Kerry and one of his colleagues, I think it was Arlen Specter, introduced a bill to, in effect, to establish a national high-speed rail authority. We've got $1.5 billion in a bill signed by President Bush in October, which contained funding for the Amtrak system, but also for the first time in the history of the Congress and our country included money specifically for high-speed rail. And no other state is close to California. What happened on November 4th was a milestone.
Yes.
All Californians ought to realize the importance of what they did. God bless them.
Quentin Cobb is chairman of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. If private equity funds, pension funds are going to be invited to participate in this, what's the interest for them? Is there going to be profit from this system that
Absolutely.
Would pay them back?
Yeah, absolutely. As in any private capital investment, it's return on investment. And it isn't a question of if. We have five firms, including Goldman Sachs, for example, which have provided us written letters of interest in investing capital in the high-speed rail project and in its operation. And the forecast is they will want probably a return on investment of somewhere around 10%, and that is doable. It's feasible.
I also understand that the High-Speed Rail Authority believes that the service would not require operating subsidies, but many train systems in Europe and elsewhere do require operating subsidies.
That is not true. I want someone to show me how the word many could be used with respect to those systems. All that I know of France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Belgium, Holland, Switzerland, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan, and Asia. I won't vouch for the United Kingdom because the Eurostar, which is high speed now in England, has not operated with surplus revenue, but those systems operate with surplus revenue.
They don't require state support.
That is correct. And we intend to follow that example and that model. And the experts who have been retained forecast that model will be replicated by operation of California high-speed rail. For example, on Phase 1, the estimated expenses will be, I think, $2.2 billion. The gross revenue, about $3.3 billion. The conclusion of the people working for Parsons Brinckerhoff, the project manager, which will not do the construction or operation, is that there'll be surplus revenue of about $1.1 billion a year, which can be used not just for the rate or the return on investment of any private capital participant, but also to defray the cost of the bond, which was approved a month ago.
And finally, when is the earliest that one could expect to see a segment of the high-speed rail system running?
A segment by 2014. The entire first phase, which is, what, about 450, 460 miles, Bay Area down to Anaheim, 2018. And the second phase, which is Sacramento, meaning from Merced to Modesto to Stockton to Sacramento within 5 years thereafter. And the second phase includes going from Anaheim, not through Orange County, but through Riverside County out of Los Angeles' Union Station to San Diego. And that entire second phase, both the north part and the south part, will take about an estimated 5 years complete. And you may find a opening of a segment of sooner than that, within 2-3 years, because it'll be relatively easier with respect to the second phase than it is the first phase.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Quentin Kopp is chairman of the California High-Speed Rail Authority. It is up and running with the passage of Proposition 1A, a $10 billion bond measure. Judge Kopp, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, author Todd Borg and his mystery novel set at Lake Tahoe, the Latino holiday tradition of tamale making, too. What's it all about and how does one local family do it? We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Email us suggestions for future topics. Our address is insight@capradio.org. What's next for redistricting reform in California since voters passed Prop 11? Tomorrow we'll get a variety of perspectives from political experts. Also, Sacramento singer-songwriter Kate Gaffney. Lake Tahoe is the spectacular backdrop for a series of mystery novels starring private detective Owen McKenna. The book's author, Todd Borg, knows Tahoe well. He's lived there for some 20 years. The latest book in the McKenna series, Tahoe Avalanche, came out late summer. Around that time, I talked with Borg and asked him why he decided to set a series of mystery novels at Lake Tahoe.
Well, you know, when we first moved there in 1990, looking at the landscape was so impressive. The landscape is so large, the lake and the mountains, that it struck me immediately that it would be a very good setting for a series where the landscape would actually almost be a character. And so in the books, many of the scenes are set outdoors, and you get a real strong sense of what that landscape is like, and the weather also, because as you know, when the weather comes to Tahoe, it's serious.
Owen McKenna is a former homicide detective from San Francisco. Why did he move up to Tahoe?
Owen McKenna's backstory is that he was on the San Francisco Police Department for 20 years when he had experienced an incident that gave him one of those moments where he thought, you know what, I'm going to reevaluate my life and what I'm doing. And so without actually saying what that incident is, you find out about it in the books. He decided to leave the force and become a private investigator, partly because he was in law enforcement and he wanted to stay with his expertise, but also partly because he thought it would be a more genteel way to earn a living, which of course didn't turn out to be the case. So he moved up to Tahoe, and that's where he's been ever since.
You moved to Tahoe from somewhere else, not from San Francisco, from the other direction. Why did you move to Tahoe?
My wife and I were from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. And like many people, we had taken several vacations to Tahoe, one too many, in fact, and we decided, you know, we'd really like to live in a place with this kind of a landscape and this kind of a climate. The climate's spectacular. And so we just made the decision one day, there's never going to be a good time to move, so let's just move. So we sold everything and headed west.
Wow. Now, Minnesota has quite a lot of lakes, too.
Minnesota has a lot of lakes. It's a very pretty state. It's somewhat of a flat state, and the lakes are somewhat small. And so the contrast with Tahoe is major. And coming to Tahoe was one of those experiences that it was a big eye opener. What kind of a landscape is available out there to live in? So we headed west, and partly because we wanted to be near the other things that are in Northern California. Sacramento and the Bay Area, of course, are powerful attractions.
Todd Borg, author, lives in the Lake Tahoe area, which he uses as the backdrop to a series of mystery novels. You were not a published novelist at the time when you moved here. What did you plan to do, you and your wife, when you moved to Tahoe? How did you make it work?
We had been in the picture framing business in Minnesota. And so when we came to Tahoe, we started another picture framing business. And after 27 years, we decided just 2.5 years ago to sell so that I could write full-time and my wife could paint full-time. But while we were framing in Tahoe, I started writing in earnest.
Wow. And was that in the back of your mind when you and your wife decided to move out to Tahoe, that at some point in your future you'd be doing something different, something like writing novels?
Well, I had written several novels when we lived in Minnesota. And those novels are sitting in drawers as we speak. But I had always wanted to pursue writing. It seemed like the most marvelous way to spend your time. You know, some people look at a novel and they think, well, this would be really a complex project to undertake. You know, how would you do such a thing? And I look at it and I think, well, it's a little complex, but compared to getting up and going to work at a job every day, you know, it's kind of a dream life. You know, you make a big pot of coffee and you sit down in a little room and you make up a bunch of stuff, and that's quite a living.
What was it like the last day with the picture framing business when you realized that this source of income for you and your wife was about to go away and you were going to become a novelist? Did you second guess yourself?
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah, it was a little scary. You sort of wonder if this is the stupidest thing you're ever doing, selling your main income. But I couldn't be happier. The books are going very well, and I'm delighted that I gave it a shot. So I intended to continue with this. I really enjoy it.
Well, what was the first day like as the novelist?
I did like I just referred to. I got up, made a big pot of coffee, and sat down at the computer and made up some more stuff, told some more stories. Yeah.
How do you structure your days writing? Because that's a challenge for lots of people who like to be a published author, but it's figuring out how you're going to produce enough material every day and how much counts as enough material.
Well, you know, I'm not one of those writers who has a daily structure. I don't get up at 5 and write for 4 hours every day, anything like that. You have to, of course, be disciplined to turn out novels. There's an enormous amount of time involved in writing and editing and rewriting and re-editing, etc. So I have the discipline to do it, but I don't operate within a structure. Each day is a little different. One day I'll be doing a book signing here. Another day I'll be doing a talk someplace else. Then I wake up at 3 in the morning and I can't sleep, and I think this is a good time to write, squeeze in a little here and there. And so you kind of, you know, fit it in wherever you can. If I'm driving and I get an idea, you know, I know I shouldn't do this, but I pull out a post-it note and stick it on the steering wheel and, you know, and write down my ideas as I'm going.
So you don't have an allotment of words that you need to get through every day?
No. Some writers do, but I don't. I don't work within that kind of a structure very well.
And how do you set about creating your stories? Do they just emerge as you start typing? Or do you plot out the whole story and then the writing of the novel is basically filling in the gaps?
I think I'm like a lot of writers in that I start out with an outline, maybe 15 pages long. And this gives me the basic premise of the book and the central conflict, the main characters, and what kind of a climax it's going to build to. But I quickly tend to veer away from that. It's kind of like, I think working from an outline is a little bit like planning a road trip. You get out your maps and you've decided you're going to go from Sacramento to New York and maybe take Highway 50. My problem is I get to that first intersection in the middle of Nevada, and instead of going straight, I think it looks a lot more interesting to the left. So I abandon my map and my plans and go a whole different direction. Eventually, I usually come back to the place that I plan to at the end of the book. I usually bring that climax back over the Hudson River and into downtown New York if that's my plan. But how I get there really changes. It veers away from my intentions. And I end up writing many outlines as I go along as a result.
What happens if you discover in the course of writing the book that where you thought the story was going to end up is not where it ends up? Surely, with a mystery, you're left with the problem of threads being pulled out of the rug, and before you know it, it's all been pulled away.
That's exactly what happens. And yes, it's a real problem. Then you have to go back and restructure and figure out how you're going to pull these loose ends together, and then you rewrite, and it can be quite a trick.
I can imagine for mystery writers, it could be a little worrying when the book gets out and you know that your fans are reading it and they spot a weak spot in the story, you know, where some two things don't connect. Do you worry about that when the book goes out, that you've missed something? Because, I mean, I'm guessing you must go over it logically pretty closely since it's a mystery novel and it needs to make sense.
Yeah, I reread it many, many times. My wife, who is my primary first editor and my last editor, reads it several times. I also have four other people who are very perceptive, and they go through.
Who are they?
Well,
you don't have to name them, but how did you come upon them?
A couple are English majors. One's an attorney, a former prosecutor, smart people who know the ins and outs of both books and how to construct a decent sentence. So they do a very good job of catching my loose ends, the things that I missed, little plot problems, that kind of thing. And they also do a good job of catching, you know, the typos and that sort of thing too. So I'm very fortunate that way. Of course, some mistakes do get through. And yes, once in a while, a reader will write me and say, you know, you said alter when you meant alter. There's two different, you know, spellings. And of course, spell check doesn't catch those things. And writers tend to flatter ourselves when, after all of the editing process goes through and mistakes still get through, we tend to say, oh, well, of course, they were so tuned into the story that they never even noticed the writing. And boy, it must really be working, you know, that kind of thing.
Lake Tahoe-based author Todd Borg's new novel is called Tahoe Avalanche. It's the sixth in a series of mystery novels starring the private detective Owen McKenna. The books have Lake Tahoe as the backdrop. The titles of all of the books start with Tahoe.
Yes.
Do you get worried about running out of nouns to follow Tahoe that will sound good as a title?
There are probably an infinite number of combinations that might work. But yeah, I kind of wonder about it. I sometimes, when I come up with an idea for another book, I think, well, what in the world's going to be the title of this one? And it's a question. But when you do a series, it's very helpful, as you know, to have a series identifier in the title. And so there are people who will discover my book. I'll get an email from someone say, yeah, I found your book in my bookstore in Philadelphia. And maybe a year or two from now, that person won't remember what my name is. But when they go to find out about my new book and they decide to Google me, they'll type in, oh, yeah, Tahoe Mysteries, that kind of thing. And up pops the book. So the identifier works really well, and it's worth whatever is the downside in trying to find the next set of titles.
Where does the title come in the process? Do you start with a title and that inspires the basic story? Or do you write the story and then go, well, this is Tahoe Avalanche?
The title, I think, comes really late in the process. Typically, I think I'm like a lot of writers in that we have many more ideas than we could ever turn into books. And for me, I use what I think of as a what-if scenario. I think of it a concept, and then I change it a little bit and say to myself, what if? So, for example, on the book that came out last year, Tahoe Silence, I had heard, I believe, on NPR a story about autism. And as you know, of course, many times because autistic kids have trouble communicating, they sometimes are misdiagnosed and sometimes they are thought to have not as much mental activity going on as they maybe really do. But we can't tell because we can't communicate them. So my what-if scenario with that was, what if there was a 17-year-old girl who couldn't speak? In fact, the communication part of her brain isn't working at all. She can't use sign language. She can't write. Hence her nickname, Silence. And then I thought, oh, well, there's my title, Tahoe Silence. But the what-if scenario is a very good way to come up with an idea. And I took that concept and went one notch further and said, what if this girl has a priceless secret and she's kidnapped for that secret because the kidnapper thinks he can make a fortune with it? But of course, being unable to communicate, she can't say what it is. And so the idea and the title and it all just came together, all in one.
Well, you mentioned silence, and that leads me to this question. That woman, Silence Ramirez, and there's also in Tahoe Avalanche, March Carrera. These are very colorful names. How do you come up with them?
When you're looking at names in a mystery, there's a couple of things you need to consider. One is the character a sympathetic character? Are they a person that no one would mind having the same name with? Or are they a really notorious bad guy and do bad things, in which case then maybe you would have to wonder, what if somebody else shares this name? How are they going to think about it? So there's two approaches. You can come up with a very unusual name that perhaps no one else in the country has. Silence Ramirez might be a singular name. The other approach is you can name your character Bob Smith, and that way, whether it's a good guy or a bad guy, you don't have to worry that someone's going to say, wait a second, you named a character after me and made me look bad, that kind of thing. I tend to lean toward the colorful names. I think it adds a little bit more interest, and it's easier to kind of engage the reader if they pick up a book and they're reading about someone named Silence. Or in fact, for example, Owen McKenna's girlfriend is named Street Casey in the book. Street's a forensic entomologist. She's very important. She was named Street because her parents didn't get to the hospital in time when she was born. She was born in the street. And so that becomes a much more memorable thing for readers than the Bob Smiths of the name world.
Todd Borg is an author who lives in the Lake Tahoe area, which he uses as the backdrop to a series of six mystery novels, the Owen McKenna Mysteries. Todd Borg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I had a good time.
I spoke with Todd Borg in September. He has a public event this weekend in Reno. He's at Sundance Bookstore on Sunday morning. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Tamale making is an ancient tradition in the Americas. In recent times, it's become a popular part of Christmas in Mexico and among people of Mexican descent. What's so special about making tamales in the holidays with family and friends? And how do you make a great tamale? This time last year, I spoke with Linnea Edmeyer, a Sutter Creek woman who at that time also happened to be an associate producer of Insight. I asked her about the tamale making tradition in her household.
In my household, we typically do it about a week or two before Christmas, and it's a time for all of us to get together. We invite friends, and it's usually a three-day process, so an entire weekend.
Well, a couple of weeks before Christmas means we're inside that time frame. Have you mm-hmm. made your tamales?
Yes. I spent this last weekend making them.
Oh, goodness. And who was helping?
Well, family, my husband and a couple of friends, and a couple of friends who've never done it before, so that was very fun. It's always fun to have people in who've never done it because it's a different perspective.
Yeah. Was this part of your childhood?
Yes, it was, but my mother would typically cook the meat during the day, and it was sort of this mysterious thing because the next morning we'd wake up and there'd be fresh tamales. And now that I've done it and I have children, I realize why she did it when we were all asleep. It's a very time-consuming process, and when you're trying to chase the little ones around, it gets a little more difficult. So it is something that we tend to do a lot of the cooking of the meat and some of those things, but the actual putting together we tend to do late in the evening.
Mm. Well, we have also in the studio a couple of assistant tamale makers. They are Philip Ball and Rachel Burns. And Linnea, tell us what they're doing.
Well, Philip's at the beginning of the process, and I have to sort of back up because what you're seeing here is really the last 1/16th of the entire process. It's so time-consuming, and there's so many different steps. But Philip has got the husk, and he is spreading a very thin layer of masa on the husk.
What's masa?
Masa is it's probably what you would call like a dough. And it's made out of corn, and we don't make ours homemade. We go to a market, and there's a wonderful little market, family market, that I get mine from, and they make it fresh for me when I come in. So that's really special. But Philip is spreading the masa on the husk, and
that's the inside of the husk.
Yes, it is, yeah. They've been softened already. You can see right here we've got a husk that we brought in that hasn't been softened. It's just very stiff and brittle.
What? Yeah, I'm just holding it right now. I mean, it doesn't seem like something you could cook with. How do you soften them?
No, you soak them in warm water, and you start to open them up. And then once they soften, you can open them up and pull any of the imperfections, we call them, out. And so then they're soft once they've absorbed a little bit of the water.
Okay, so Philip is spreading the inside mm-hmm. of the husks with the masa. Correct. And then Rachel. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, continue. You're fine. He's passing them over to Rachel, and she's putting the filler, which is pork today, a little bit of pork.
And that's what I'm smelling, is it?
Yes, it is.
Spicy.
And the pork is made, we have cumin in there and garlic, and the sauce that the pork is actually mixed with, we make the sauce homemade also. And the peppers, we've got some peppers on the table here, and again, they're dried peppers, and we boil them, and the saying goes, once everybody's eyes in the house are watering and once everybody is coughing, you know the peppers are done.
So Rachel is spreading the pork.
She's
putting sauce over the masa.
Right. She's putting a very narrow bit of pork down the middle, and then she's making two folds crosswise, and then she flips up the bottom like a little tail and tucks it in, and then from there they will go into a steamer. And depending on how many we cook at a time, if we're doing my pots here on the table, and it's quite a large pot, as you can see, if we do 7 dozen in the big pot, then that's about an hour and a half cooking time.
You mentioned the pot. Our senior producer, Jen Picard, took a picture of this pot. And when you mentioned, Linnea, when you arrived at the studio, that you had your pots in the car, I thought, well, pots. But this is like no pot I've seen before. It's absolutely gigantic. It's like the robot in Star Wars.
I was just going to say, it looks like you could go to the moon in that thing.
Yeah, and we have a picture of it on our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Tell us how big the pot is and why it's so big.
The pot is actually, essentially, we use the bigger pot just because we're doing so many at a time. Mm-hmm. If we're doing just like if you wanted to do it at home and you're maybe doing a couple dozen, you would just use a big, maybe a noodle cooking pot with a steamer in it. But these are so large because we can put about 7 dozen in each layer. And it takes about, it might take about 2 hours for about 4 people to fill 7 dozen, and then we cook them, and then while those are cooking for an hour and a half, we're putting together the next 7 dozen. So
the next 7 dozen.
Yeah, and you laugh, and it is funny. We call that the drudgery stage. When you get to about the 12th dozen, people start falling off the table.
Why so many?
Well, probably because it's a big process. So you want to get everybody to do all these dozen at one time, because once they get going, they go, you know, I really don't think I want to do this again. But that's kind of a joke in our family. But really, because everybody ends up taking some, you know, everybody gets a dozen for their time. And so when I say we've done 15 dozen, you know, there's 3 dozen left in my fridge right now. So
wow. Linnea Edmire, associate producer of Insight, is telling us about making tamales. Now, they're not quite on microphone, but Philip, have you made tamales before?
Yes, I have.
Oh, you have?
I have. Yeah.
Okay.
A couple times, actually.
Oh, you know what you're doing then. And what about you, Rachel?
No, I've never made tamales.
Yes, okay.
So it's a good experience.
Yes. Okay, very nice. How are they doing, Linnea?
They're doing beautifully. There's no wrong way, really, to do it. There's usually one more person in the process. There's usually 3 people going on one side, and we call that middle person the quality control person, and that person just makes sure there's enough masa, there's enough meat, and everything's uniform, so when they go in the pot, they all more or less come out the same size.
Does everyone help make the tamales? Mm-hmm. Does everyone willingly help make the tamales? Maybe it's a better question.
I guess we're all laughing here, but yeah, and there's so many stages. There's so many things to do. You would normally have about 6 to 10 people working at one time, because you've got maybe 4 or 5 people just spreading, and you've got another 2 or 3 people at the sink softening up the husks. So it's a very big process when you do this many. Even if you're only doing a dozen, it's still a big process.
So the guys help out?
Of course they do.
Very nice.
You know, they help out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
If they want to eat, right, Philip?
What's the secret to a great tamale, at least your great tamales?
My great tamales. Well, if you're talking about the freshness of a tamale, it has to be the masa. My mom always said that the masa has to be very fresh, and the better your masa, the better the tamale. But I have another philosophy. I think the secret is who's around the table and the conversation in the room.
Mm, I see.
What happens? What goes on during the making? And people will tell you things they've never told you before, and it's because you're spending hours with somebody around a table, and there's really nothing more to do but talk.
So who was around your table this weekend? Was it all family? Was it friends?
No, too? It wasn't. It was some friends. A cousin. I had a cousin come up and her daughter, and it was the first time her daughter had ever tried tamales, and she was actually trying to do Philip's job with the spreading of the masa, and she was getting so frustrated. She had us all laughing, but at one point she said, "Can't I just put my fingers in it and spread it like dough?" And so, you know, and I learned something about her that I didn't know. She, at one point, I saw her with a piece of paper and a pencil, and I asked her, "What are you doing?" And she was sketching everybody around the table. I had no idea she was an artist. And so it's little things like that.
Would you eat the tamales on Christmas Day?
Sometimes. In our family, we would make the tamales late, and then if we went to midnight mass, that was our snack after we got back from mass.
Great. Do you have anything for me to taste?
Yes, I do.
I'm
getting hungry.
That's the most important.
I can't really eat too much before the program, but since we're at the end, if I'm spluttering over bits of pork and so on, it won't matter too much. We're making tamales in the Insight studio. Our master chef is Linnea Edmire. She's an associate producer of Insight. And
I'm going to direct you, Jeffrey.
Okay,
you
just please direct me, yes.
You just lift the corners.
Lift
just,
the corners.
Just lift where you see it starting to unravel.
Oh, I see.
And
like
you
here.
Just pick it up.
Okay, you do it. Just
roll,
as
roll it out. Yeah.
That. Okay.
There you go. And I'm going to make you eat it with your fingers.
Okay. Should I keep on rolling it?
No, there you go. Just take a bite.
Mmm. Yummy. That's nice. Nice bit of spice in there. I like it.
A little warm. Good.
Mmm. I enjoy it very much. By the way, I've got to ask, there's a jar of gloopy-looking stuff on the table. What's that for? Am I eating that?
Well, yes, you are, as a matter of fact. And making tamales is not for the faint of heart. Once the meat is cooked, we let the meat cool overnight, and we let the fat come to the top, and we end up skimming some of the fat and putting it into the masa and the broth we use for the sauce.
Mm, I just ate an even bigger bit of spicy pork, and it's wonderful. No, it's tremendous. More photographs of the actual tamale making have been added to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. I'm now regretting eating because I can hardly speak. So I will thank Linnea Edmire for our tamale making session and also the assistants, Philip Ball and Rachel Burns. Thank you.
Thanks, thank you,
Linnea.
Jeffrey.
We talked about tamales last December on Insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Reminder that if you go to capradio.org/insight, you'll see photographs of the tamale making, the participants, and that famous massive pot that looks like one of the robots in Star Wars. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Big-time California high school football is usually played between teams from the Bay Area and the Los Angeles area, but this weekend, a Sacramento team will play in a California high school football bowl game. It's Grand High playing Long Beach Poly in the open division game at the Home Depot Center in Carson. Grant High's coach recently described this as the pinnacle of all the things they've worked on over the years. Joining me to talk about this is a Sacramento Bee sports writer who's covering this issue. He's Joe Davidson, and he's on the line. Joe Davidson, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Good to hear from you.
Was it a surprise when Grant was chosen for the bowl championship?
Well, it was a pleasant surprise. certainly for the region, because Grant was really trying to target the Division One game. The open division game that they landed in is the premier game. It's the game of the year, and they get a chance to go against Long Beach Poly, the number two ranked high school team in the country, which has sent more products into the NFL than anybody in national high school history, with 59 players. And so Grant has officially arrived on the big stage, and it's a milestone achievement for high school athletics around here. And it's a big victory for the public schools, too, because so many of these games, Jeffrey, include private schools.
Some people, I think it would be fair to say, expected or guessed that De La Salle of Concord would be chosen for this open division game. Did you share that expectation? And was it a surprise that Grant was chosen over De La Salle?
Yeah, it was a surprise because there's so much emphasis placed on the private schools and the allure and attraction of De La Salle, which certainly has an incredible resume and pedigree. And you know, a lot of people assume that, well, they'll just go with the safe choice there, but you know, maybe the logical choice finally prevails. So, you know, Grant is undefeated. Dale Sal had one defeat, and Grant has an incredible strength of schedule where they played and beat two large school state champions from out of state, one in Utah, one in Idaho. And, you know, it's good to see that the voting committee didn't stick with tradition and schools that have been there before. They went with a fresh new choice, and I think Grant will represent well. I think also in the future, Jeffrey, we'll see Grant and De La Salle play games during the regular season, since those two teams have really emerged as front runners, as premier programs. De La Salle always has been, and Grant is getting there.
I'm talking with Sacramento Bee sports writer Joe Davidson about Grant High School, which is playing the college California High School high school college football bowl game this Saturday. Grant has long been the top or one of the top high school college football programs in this area, correct?
Oh yeah, the school's been around since the 40s. They've sent people on to the NFL, and since the, you know, since the 1990s or 1991, since Mike Alberghini became the head coach, he was the defensive coordinator throughout the 1980s, they really have just taken a surge forward, and it's just an interesting dynamic out there. You have Grant is located right there in Grand Avenue in a hard part of town with the urban sprawl of tire shops and barber shops and liquor stores and bars on windows. But there is so much immense pride with that football team and just outpouring of support. And it's generations of players come through there, their brothers and cousins and aunts and uncles and everybody in the family, fathers and grandfathers, went to school there, played sports there. So it's a community town in every regard, especially for an old school like that. And it's one of the most refreshing stories every year.
Has something happened at Grant in the past year to improve their program? Has the program improved, or is it something about the other teams in California that aren't playing quite as well?
They've been consistently outstanding for a lot of years. They've won six section championships, which for years was the last game you could play until now with this bowl game. And they've just keep improving the program. They've got college players all across the country, including two starters at Cal, and that's not an easy school to get into, at Cal Berkeley. And they've both been four-year starters, and they're both going to graduate early. So it's been, you know, they've had their share of scholars and football players, and it's clearly emerged as the area's best program in the last two decades.
What does this mean for Sacramento High School football?
Well, Jeffrey, I think it just shows that, you know, that there's legitimate football here, and people who've lived here, covered it, played it, coached it, have known that for years. But now I think that, you know, the country knows, and I say the country because, you know, these games are on a national scale because Long Beach Poly is ranked number two in the country, and that's who Grant plays. And it shows that, you know, the time is now where football is not just Southern California, not just the Bay Area, not just down there, and everybody else is just, you know, along for the ride. So I think it's a huge boost, and I think it'll inspire other teams around here to ramp up their schedule as well and play teams from out of area and out of state.
As good as Grant High School is, Long Beach Poly is going to be a tough opponent.
Brutally tough. I mean, this is a team that's 14-0. They have 5,000 students on that campus. It might be the largest high school in the country. It's certainly the largest in California, which is the most populated state in the country with the most high schools in the country. And, you know, Grant's got 1,700 kids. So it's like a town going against a village, and, school versus school. But both teams are very athletic, very explosive, a lot of recruits on each team. It should be a really entertaining game. It's going to be on Comcast Sports California, so people could see it on TV. So people won't be bored. This will be good fun.
And it's a fairly quite a nice venue, the Home Depot Center. That's a fairly new soccer stadium for Los Angeles' two Major League Soccer teams.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful facility. Kids will love it. You know, the Grant players, Jeffrey, earlier this year, they opened their season with a long bus trip up to Idaho to play the defending state champion up there and beat them. And so they're used to travel. They're used to the big stage. And time of their lives for a lot of these kids. A lot of these kids, this is what they have. They don't have a lot at home. They don't have a lot of, you know, security with family and broken up families, but they have each other, and they have this football memory that should last forever.
Joe Davidson, Sacramento Bee sports writer. Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
We've been talking about the Grant High School football team, which is playing at the Home Depot Center in Carson this Saturday, the Open Division Bowl game, part of the California Interscholastic Federation Championship Bowl Games. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today's engineer was Evan Mansler with help from Nick Bruner. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. What's next for redistricting reform in California since voters passed Prop 11? On the next Insight, we'll get a variety of perspectives from political experts. Also, Sacramento singer-songwriter Kate Gaffney talks about her latest album and performs two of her songs. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on KXJZ.